From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning to you. I'm Ira Melman. Coming your way, the U.S. Secretary of State tries to clarify the U.S. stance in Asia during a China visit. President Obama talks with the candidates in Afghanistan's election. And our Jim Stevenson talks with an author who took a very long bicycle ride through China. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. U.S. and Chinese officials have opened talks in Beijing, where Chinese President Xi Jinping says Washington and Beijing are working to avoid confrontation that he says would be a disaster. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has more.
These talks are taking place against the background of increasing tension between China and its neighbors in the South China Sea, where Vietnam says one of its patrols was rammed by China's Coast Guard near a Chinese oil rig in disputed waters. Beijing has warned against outside interference in the region, and Washington has not taken a position on competing territorial claims. Secretary of State John Kerry says a more active U.S. role in Asia is not meant to contain China.
We welcome the emergence of a peaceful, stable, prosperous China that contributes to the stability and the development of the region and that chooses to play a responsible role in world affairs.
At the opening of this strategic and economic dialogue, Kerry said Washington and Beijing have the ability to find common ground despite any current differences.
That's the foundation on which we need to build decades of prosperity for the future and also build the possibilities of stability and peace at the same time.
Chinese President Xi Jinping says confrontation between the United States and China benefits no one.
China-U.S. confrontation to the two countries and to the world would definitely be a disaster. Under these circumstances, we on both sides should look far into the distance, strengthen and persist on cooperation, and avoid confrontation.
During the past few years, these rotating talks have failed to produce much of substance, but they have helped diffuse hostilities that former U.S. Ambassador to China Stapleton Roy says would divide the region.
That's not the type of world we want. And therefore, it's very important for us to have mechanisms that work in trying to address the types of issues that arise between two countries, such as the United States and China. And I think the strategic and economic dialogue is one of those mechanisms.
American Enterprise Institute analyst Michael Oslin says these SNED talks accomplish nothing.
Relations between Beijing and Washington are worse than ever. Why do we continue the fiction that the SNED is either important or constructive in any way?
Oslin says Washington's naive about Chinese ambition.
This does not mean we make China our number one enemy. It does not mean you create an Asian NATO against China. I think it means that you just act realistically and understand that Beijing has very little interest in upholding any of the norms that we profess are important to us in working constructively with us or our allies.
Talks in Beijing continue Thursday on bilateral investments and currency valuation. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Also under discussion at the meetings in Beijing is climate change. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Chinese counterpart announced Wednesday the launch of 8 environmental pilot programs. They include capturing the store and storing carbon and setting up more efficient energy grids. However, the world's two top carbon emitters still differ over a wider global plan to cut emissions. China's climate chief, Xi Jinhua, told reporters his country still cannot be expected to match the environmental reforms of the U.S. and other wealthy nations. Typhoon Niigori is taking aim at Japan's most populous areas after dumping torrential rains on the southern islands of Okinawa. Two people were killed, at least 28 injured, as the storm moved across Okinawa Wednesday, leaving 52,000 houses without power. Though it is weakened, Niigori is still packing wind gusts of up to 162 kilometers per hour. But the main concern now is the slow-moving storm's heavy rainfall. Forecasters warn that the island of Kyushu could see at least 300 millimeters of rain in a 24-hour period through midday Thursday. The storm is expected to hit Kyushu early Thursday before heading for Honshu, Japan's main island where Tokyo and Osaka are located. Niigori, which means raccoon in Korean, is posing a particular threat of landslides and floods since it's hitting Japan at the end of its rainy season. Japan usually is hit by several typhoons each year, but it is unusual for such a storm to hit as early as July. North Korea has fired two short-range ballistic missiles into the ocean off of its east coast, the fourth such test in under 2 weeks. South Korean defense officials say the suspected Scud missiles fired Wednesday from the western Wonghae province had a range of about 500 kilometers. The missiles landed in the body of water South Korea refers to as the East Sea, and which Tokyo calls the Sea of Japan. Yoshihide Suga, the Japanese chief cabinet secretary, condemned the launch. In recent weeks, North Korea has expanded its UN sanction-defying ballistic missile test while pushing South Korea to accept a deal to reduce tensions. Seoul has rejected the offer, saying Pyongyang must first take steps to show it's committed to dismantling its nuclear program. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. President Obama has intervened in Afghanistan's disputed presidential election, urging the two candidates to shun violent or extra-constitutional means or face a cutoff of U.S. assistance. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. officials, while acknowledging serious fraud allegations, are calling for quick implementation of auditing measures to pave the way for a new legitimate government and a post-NATO bilateral security agreement.
Mr. Obama, speaking with former Afghan Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah Monday and former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani Tuesday, stressed the United States expects a thorough review of all reasonable allegations of fraud from the June 14 runoff vote. He called on all parties to avoid steps that undermine Afghanistan's national unity, saying there is no justification for resorting to violent or extra-constitutional means, and warning that would result in an end of U.S. assistance to Kabul. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jennifer Psaki Tuesday said such a cutoff of aid is not considered a threat.
That statement was in response to the fact that there have been reports on the ground of plans to declare victory, to create a parallel government. Both of those steps would be illegal. And it's not a threat, it's a fact that certainly we wouldn't be able to provide the kind of support that it is our preference to provide if those type of steps were taken.
The special U.S. representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, James Dobbins, says Afghanistan has made tremendous progress over the past 13 years and describes the idea of a parallel presidency as destructive. In an interview with VOA, the diplomat said the United States wants to see the stalemate between the two candidates resolved and political discussions between the parties to continue. He said Washington and its partners would not be able to support a divided Afghanistan at odds with itself.
Clearly, if either or both of these efforts fail, Afghanistan would be badly divided, and this would have a very deleterious effect on the prospects for peace and prosperity in that country and for the continued commitment of not just the United States, but the entire international community.
Preliminary results from the runoff election have Abdullah losing to Ashraf Ghani by some 1 million votes. But Abdullah Tuesday said he is the winner without any doubt and vowed to never accept what he called a fraudulent government. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank says from Abdullah's perspective, this is not an unreasonable position to take.
He feels as if he lost the 2009 election due to fraud. And he feels that he bowed out in 2009 for the good of the country. In this case, he also feels that he is losing on the basis of fraud, and he is doing whatever he can to change the narrative to avoid, as he sees it, a victory for him being snatched away by fraud.
Jen Psaki says Afghanistan's Electoral Commission and the Complaints Commission need to examine all such allegations of fraud.
There are serious allegations. They need to be looked into. There needs to be a review of all the ballots that may or may not be legitimate. There are also some UN proposals that we think the electoral body should be working with them on. And at the same time, the candidates and their supporters need to be in conversations with each other about the formation of a government of national unity, and a government that includes all of the relevant parties and important groups. And we feel both of those steps are important moving forward.
There are reports that Secretary of State John Kerry, currently in Beijing for a U.S.-China economic and strategic dialogue, may travel to Kabul on Friday. Dobbins said Kerry will want to meet with both candidates and try to work with them to see whether both the formal process of examining the ballots and determining the results of the election can go forward in a mutually agreed fashion. As for a bilateral security agreement yet to be signed by the U.S. and Afghanistan, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said Tuesday the BSA must be signed by September, or maintaining a force beyond 2014, when the NATO combat mission ends, will be problematic. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the agreement is in the best interest of both American national security and the people of Afghanistan.
For them to sign this agreement, the election needs to be concluded. And because of the concerns that have been raised about fraud, the conclusion of that election is being drawn out a little bit. Fortunately, there is in place a series of procedures to adjudicate concerns about fraud. We have sought through diplomatic channels to encourage both sides to allow that process to work. And we're hopeful that both candidates and their supporters will continue to support that process as it moves forward.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby Tuesday said the electoral dispute is not affecting the U.S.-Afghan security relationship.
It's the first democratic transition of power in Afghanistan's history. It's historic on an epic scale. And yes, there's complications. We're certainly monitoring that and watching that and encouraging both candidates to let the process continue. It doesn't do anybody any good to threaten violence. We want to get a complete audit of the votes, the second round returns, before any kind of formal announcement is made one way or the other. We're not picking sides here. The only side that we're on is the side of the Afghan people, and I think we just need to keep focused on that. And there's absolutely no change in our commitment to the peaceful, stable future of Afghanistan.
Diplomat James Dobbins says while he would have preferred withholding the election's preliminary results until further audit measures were in place, he urges both candidates to quickly accept proposed UN auditing measures so the process can be completed in time for an August 2nd inauguration of Afghanistan's next president. He says what is crucial is a legitimate election result and a government that represents the major elements of Afghan society. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The number of Afghan civilians, including children, killed in violence rose by nearly 17% in the first half of this year in Afghanistan compared with the same period in 2013, as the fight is increasingly taking place closer to homes in populated areas. So says a new United Nations report. The trend comes as the Taliban and other militants grow bolder with their attacks on Afghan security forces in the fight for the control of key routes and other territory ahead of the withdrawal of U.S. and allied combat troops by the end of the year. In Indonesia's closely contested presidential election, both candidates are declaring they have the mandate to lead, despite preliminary results showing a very close race. Kate Lamb has more on the day's events.
At polling stations across the capital Wednesday, Indonesian voters were equally divided on their pick for the next president. Supporters of Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he is known, said they wanted to see a change in the old guard and admired Widodo for the tangible changes he has made in Jakarta. Widodo is especially popular among young Indonesians, 67 million of whom voted for the first time. The older generations tended to side with his opponent, former Army General Prabowo Subianto, arguing that Indonesia needs a strong and firm leader to hold the country together. After a nail-biting day in which exit polls swung widely in favour of one candidate or the other, just hours after voting closed, Widodo declared that he had won.
Sampai saat ini menunjukkan bahwa...
Speaking at a conference, he told reporters that based on the results of a quick count, he and his running mate, Yusuf Kala, had won. The quick count, which is based on a sample of votes conducted by the reputable Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, put Widodo in front with 52.74% of the vote against Prabowo with 47.26%. But in a matter of an hour, Prabowo Subianto also gave a televised address saying that he had also received a mandate to lead.
Memang menunggu sampai semua data masuk.
In the address, Prabowo thanked the Indonesian populace for trust and support and said that based on quick counts and surveys, he had been given a mandate to lead. The two quick counts that show Prabowo in front, conducted by Puskaptis and the Indonesia Voice Network, are seen as less credible than CSIS. On national television, the counts are also divided along partisan lines, depending on who owns each channel. Metro TV, owned by Jokowi supporter Surya Paolo, have showed scenes of Jokowi and his party celebrating. According to other channels, most of which back Prabowo, show he is the new president. Voters in both camps said they hoped the polls would go smoothly and peacefully, without any demonstrations or riots. Some 30,000 soldiers have been deployed across the country to maintain order. It's unclear whether the conflicting declarations will be swiftly resolved. The official result to be announced by the Election Commission will not be made until July 21st, more than 2 weeks away. Political analysts say the country will remain in political limbo until the General Election Commission announces the result. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb in Jakarta.
The ability of humans to overcome obstacles and achieve great goals is nothing short of marvelous. An innate nomadic drive and curiosity has taken men across continents, oceans, even to the moon and back. Adventurer and motivational speaker Rob Lilwall has followed that spirit in an amazingly long bicycle ride and his latest trek, a 5,000-kilometer hike through China, which became a book entitled Walking Home from Mongolia. Lilwall tells Daybreak Asia's Jim Stevenson his school classmates would never have guessed he would become such a long-distance traveler.
As I was growing up, I was never the toughest person at school. I was never in the top sports team. And I used to get frightened of things very easily. But I think if we set a good challenge we want to do, maybe find a friend or two to do it with and start small and build it up, I think we can get really surprised at what we are able to pull off in the end.
Well, you went about 5,000 kilometers. How long did that take?
It took just over 6 months, and we tended to walk about 6 days a week, and about every 6 weeks we took maybe 5 days off. By the end of the walk, I just felt like I was a ruined man, really. It was pretty hard.
How did you figure out where you were going to walk from, and how did you decide to walk this long distance to begin with?
The origins of this expedition, kind of a bit of a long story, but to cut it short, I had decided I wanted to go and explore the world on my bicycle, but instead of setting off from England and cycling off into the world, I thought it would be more fun if I started as far away from home as possible and then cycled back again. So I jumped on a plane, flew to northeast Russia, and then cycled home, and that took me about 3 years. But along the way on that trip, I had met a beautiful girl when I was in Hong Kong, who then I married. So I'd met my wife-to-be. We moved back to live in Hong Kong, which became my new home. And then once we'd arrived in Hong Kong, I started thinking, I want to do another expedition. This time I want to walk instead of cycle. And I thought, I like the idea of trying to get home. So this time I'm going to fly up to Mongolia and walk home from there.
You must have had some incredible scenery, though, along the way that you could only have seen by hiking this.
I think China is just extraordinary in its variation. As you go from north to south, you've got, you know, the Gobi Desert in the north, which is we were walking across in winter. So it's just this kind of epic, bleak, white, flat emptiness. And then you continue down, it gets a bit more hilly. We crossed the Great Wall, and then we actually followed the Great Wall for about a week just through the mountains of Shaanxi Province. And that was incredible because you're walking through this landscape of what's called loess, this soft sandstone-like material, which a lot of people have just dug into the side of and built their houses, a bit like hobbit houses, out of the side of the hills. And then we got down to the Yellow River, which was completely frozen over, and we were scrambling along the scree slopes next to the Yellow River. which is just incredibly, you know, massive kind of canyon you're walking through. And then the summer started to arrive, and as we entered southern China, you're suddenly in this much more tropical climate of bamboos and forests and much more limestone mountains and the famous castes of Guangxi province. And so we did encounter this incredible diversity of landscape. It's amazing how just in a couple of days walking, you encounter totally different types of China.
You made the trip with expedition filmmaker Leon McCarran, who was able, obviously, to record this visually. Did you ever feel that the two of you were in any sort of maybe a precarious situation along the way, or had some security fears as you're just basically going alone through this?
We did face dangers along the way. About a week into the walk, the winter had started to arrive. The temperature had dropped from minus 10 to almost minus 30. And one night, we put up our tent in the middle of this empty valley in the Gobi Desert, and everything was quite calm when we went to sleep. But then the next morning, we were woken up by this massive wind, a kind of storm blowing through. All our water had frozen, and we were running out of food a bit. So we had to keep moving. We had to get up, take the tents down in the storm, and everything almost blew away, which is a major danger if you lose your tent or something like that in the desert. And it's a real danger to get frostbite. I've got this funny video of us just dancing in the desert because it's the only way we could warm up. Other situations which are dangerous, things like sometimes the paths we ended up walking along were pretty precarious with, you know, huge 100-foot drops down into gullies or rivers. The traffic, I think, is actually one of your number one dangers if you're spending much time on a road, because it only takes one driver to be not concentrating for a couple of seconds, and that's the end. But I would say China, it didn't feel much threat from crime. China always felt very warm and friendly and pretty safe.
You must have a thousand wonderful memories from this, but what are some of the things that really stand out the most in your mind from your journey?
There are different types of highlights. The Great Wall that we saw was not full of tourists. This was out in the middle of nowhere with literally nobody on it for hundreds of miles. So that was a great, great privilege and experience. I think the other side of the highlights was the people we met, whether it was coming across some nomads who would invite us to stay, or once we got into mainland China. I remember one night we were walking down a railway through the desert, and we got to this little kind of signal house. And these guys, we knocked on the door and walked in, and they all almost kind of fell over themselves because they couldn't believe these two strange foreigners were appearing. And then they just became so hospitable, invited us and fed us and looked after us. And it was, you feel like made these really good friends who we'll never see again, but it was a really special experience. I hope for them as much as for us.
Well, I was going to ask you about the end of the trip and how it felt as you were getting closer to Hong Kong and you could almost smell the finish line there and actually see the city come into sight.
The end of expeditions is always a magical time. The funny thing about the end of this expedition is it was a lot of changes because we're walking through the countryside for, you know, weeks and weeks, and then suddenly you get to Guangzhou, which is this massive city of 15 or 20 million people. And it took literally about a week of walking through a factory belt to get to Hong Kong. We came over at Final Hill, and you look out, and for the first time we saw the ocean. You know, we'd started in the desert. We hadn't seen the ocean for months, and you see the ocean, and then you see all the familiar skyscrapers of Hong Kong. Leon, my cameraman, he's from Northern Ireland, and he grew up right next to the sea. So he was on the point of tears, really, when he saw the water again. And we walked down into the city and got to the harbour waterfront where my wife, Christine, was waiting for us. So, a sight for sore eyes when I saw her.
Rob Lowell, adventurer and motivational speaker based in Hong Kong. His book, Walking Home from Mongolia, 10 Million Steps Through China, is published by Hodder & Stoughton. Rob Lowell and cameraman Leon McCarran also raised funds from their journey for Viva, a charity devoted to seeing children safe, well, and fulfilling their natural potential. Lowell spoke from Hong Kong with Daybreak Asia's Jim Stevenson. That'll wrap things up for us on Daybreak Asia. I thank you for joining us on this day. I'm Ira Melman. Stay tuned for the latest world news on International Edition with Ray Kugel, coming up next on many of these same frequencies.